I think it was from 1 Corinthians 11 with women with headpieces. One of those nice, easy spots in Scripture. It's easy to understand. When Peter says something's hard to understand, welcome to the jungle. Right here, 1 Corinthians 11.
Could you expand your Scripture? Because I only see a third of it.
Yeah, half of it.
In fact, let me do this. I'll just do a share screen with everybody. Soon.
Can you unplug it and plug it back in? From your computer. Can you unplug it and plug it back in?
This?
Yes.
Cool.
Okay. How's that?
RGB. Form gracefully.
There we go.
Is that too little, too big?
That's
just
good.
I know the folks on Zoom can see it. It's just going to be the same. I have what? Let me make sure we see it here. This is a great passage for us to be humbled by. Because what it does is that when you read something like this, it causes you to realize that, gosh, I don't know how to answer this, or I don't know what this means. How can, you know, what does he mean by this, or how does this fit together here? And many times when you go back and you read the commentaries on this, which I've had a chance to do many times in the past, to try to find ins and outs on it, you've got people, I don't want to say all over the page, but they're trying to make some heads and tails of what, not only what Paul is saying, but how he's arguing for what he's saying. So we're not, many times when someone, like he says in 1 Corinthians 7, now the things about what you wrote to me. So, you know, we don't have the letter they wrote to Paul to get that. And so a lot of times he kind of is addressing a topic, but yet he has their letter. And maybe he's talking in such a way that he's addressing their concerns in their letter to him. But we don't have that part of the dialogue. And so we just have his letter. And so sometimes trying to, you know, make a context for what the other letter might say, we have our hat in our hand and we're humbled by that because we can't be dogmatic. We don't have that letter. I can't say, what are you saying this? And they said this. And you do that, it's a lot of bravado, like you know what you're talking about. But when you're pushed a little bit, sometimes there's, you know, but what about this and what about that? And then you don't want to be, you know, as we say, handed your head, you know, back to you on being called on the carpet for something that's an obvious mistake or something. On the other hand, we do have it, and the Lord has put this in our laps, just this inspired Scripture. We want to listen to it, and we want to understand from it. Just like with any text of Scripture, here's the first rule of thumb, okay? That when you're approaching a section of Scripture, this is a great example of this, and we don't quite understand maybe the nuances, or maybe it's clear in what they're saying, we don't know how to apply it. Okay, it could be that. Like, okay, this is what he's saying to them. There you go. But the application, you know, we're wondering, should the application be exactly what he's saying here? And so when you have things like that, it teaches us, number one, that when it comes to interpretation, you look at the bigger picture before you get into the smaller picture. And there'll be times where you might not exactly know how to interpret the smaller picture. I think those passages in the Old Testament law where it talks about, like, you shouldn't boil a kid in his mother's milk or something to this effect. And you kind of look at that and you say, okay, kid isn't a human kid. He's talking about a kid goat in his mother's milk. So I don't understand all the implications of that, what's going on there. But at the same time, don't do it. Got it. You know, it's not like something I'm going to wake up on a Monday and be tempted to do. But at the same time, there's a principle behind it from the larger context, like idolatry maybe, or, you know, something to that effect. Well, that I can make application with. So a lot of times interpretation principles for us as well as application, we just have to back it up to the bigger context. We're never really going to know specifically the individual weeds of the specificities of what they were dealing with back then. They would, but it would make most sense to us. You'll find a passage in 1 Corinthians 15 where Paul is really arguing for the resurrection, and he talks about the resurrection for the, you know, being baptized for the dead. And it's like, what is that? Who's that? I've never heard of that. Paul just makes us a glancing statement by it, and he uses it as an argument against the Corinthians not believing in the resurrection. But it's like, what does that mean? I mean, we don't really find it. I mean, you got not find it here. He doesn't really elaborate, but he tells us that. So we're going to have to be content with what he does say and just kind of leave it at that. I'm always reminded of what John hears in the book of Revelation, the seven peals of thunder. And he was about to write, and the angel says, don't write that. I mean, He tells him something, and we're reading it for him not to tell us. So it's like, well, that's a humbling thing. Hey, I want you to all know that he's going to, he heard something, but he's not going to tell you. So it's like, well, why even say that? I'm just going to ignore the whole thing. No, no. I want you to know he heard it, and he knows what they said, and he was going to write it, but I don't want him to write it. I don't want you to know it. And so that tells me something. It tells us there's things that even when we approach what God has said to us, there are going to be things in the specifics we're not going to know. And we're never going to know. And that's okay. It's like in his created world, there's so many things out here that we'll never know. Think of the things we have learned just from the telescope. Centuries of before, people have never seen, never heard. But yeah, here we are. We're seeing these things. Some of these fish at the depths of the sea that, you know, we have an opportunity to see that no one's ever seen. But yet, he allows our eyes to see these things, but not everybody's. God can do that with his creation. He can do that with his word. So this section, as we come to it, we try to understand, we try to read it and listen to what Paul is trying to say and the argument he tries to make. We have to do that kind of with a hat in our hand, look for the bigger picture of what he's trying to drive home. So with that, I'm going to let Zach now kind of ask his questions on what he was going to say on 1 Corinthians 11.
Well, it's not so much a question in as much as it's just the observation of the seemingly mid-thought transition between verse 3 and verse 4. Like he just kind of switches gears, it seems like.
Right.
And I'm just wondering if he did actually switch gears or if he's just kind of...
same topic.
Of, you know, of that effect. Maybe, I don't know. I was just reading through it and I'm, yeah. You know...
Well, he does say in verse 1, be imitators of me, just as I also am of Christ. Now, some people see that as a separate paragraph relating back to what he had said in verse chapter 10 about the stronger and weaker brethren. Could be something that's kind of moving into chapter 11, where he's going to talk about the traditions, he says in verse 2. He says, now I praise you, verse 2, because you remember me in everything. And specifically, I think he's talking about not just remember me like I'm giving money, but in this area, and hold firmly to the traditions just as I delivered them to you. Now, traditions. He makes a statement about, okay, and he hadn't told us what they were. He's praising them, that all of his traditions that he has that probably implements in every church, and expects them to follow a certain liturgy in a certain order. You see some of that in Timothy, in Titus, that he praised them for that. They're not just mavericks out there on their own. So he recognizes it and even recognizes what it is. Hold firmly to the traditions, just as I delivered them to you. And then he says in verse 3, but I want you to understand that Christ is the head of every man, and the man is the head of a woman, and God is the head of Christ. Whatever is launching verse 3 from verse 2 is sort of laying the porch work to get into the house. I think of what he's going to say about praying and prophesying for women with their heads covered and things of this sort. Because I don't think he would just launch into a subject about this, you know, head of every man, this headship aspect, and head of a woman, head of Christ as God and things of that sort, unless he was going to say something about the application of that. I mean, from verse 4 on, he doesn't get into the theological aspects of only like in heaven and things of this sort. He moves straight into the aspect of praying and prophesying with something on their head. But every man who has something on his head while praying or prophesying disgraces his head. Verse 5, but every woman who has her head uncovered while praying or prophesying disgraces her head, for she is one and the same as the woman whose head is shaved. So undoubtedly, we see something right off the bat here about women praying and prophesying and men praying and prophesying that there should be, at least here, a decorum in a public setting so that there's not a disgrace factor. Because he seems to be bringing out, just observing the text. I'm not talking about the specifics of it. I'm just observing what he's talking about. It's a man having something on his head, how it disgraces it, a woman having... not having something on her head, how it disgraces her head. In fact, she doesn't. He makes the point that she is one of the same as somebody who has her head shaved, which I'm assuming is supposed to be, whether it's shaved like bald headed or crew cutted or whatever else, is supposed to be to the effect that she resembles a man.
Okay.
Now, verse 6. Now, he kind of moves a little from that and says, for if a woman does not cover her head, let her have her hair cut off. For it is disgraceful for a woman to have her hair cut off or her head shaved, let her cover her head. So here's this either or kind of thing. And of course, most of them are not going to want to have their head shaved, so he's making an argument for them to have their head covered. And then he says in verse 7, for a man ought not to have his head covered, since he is the image and glory of God. So here his argument is for the uncovering of the man's head, is that he's the image and glory of God. But the woman is the glory of man, which, once again, is going to be his argument for having her head covered. For man, verse 8, does not originate from woman, but woman from man. For indeed, man was not created for the woman's sake, but woman for man's sake. Therefore, the woman ought to have a symbol of authority on her head because of the angels. So we'll take those 10 verses before we get to verse 11, which he seems to shift some because he's going to talk about how their interdependence upon one another is crucial. But this argument here of Paul in verse 4 through 10, I'll open it up for discussion, or maybe a question you might have had about that. There you go. No one's got questions. Clear the bell. Let's move on.
Right. It does seem, at least, that he's saying, you know, there's an order. There's a divine order in here that he's dealing with.
Yeah, verse 3, I mean, because he could have just jumped in right after verse 2 with the traditions and said verse 4. So why does he say verse 3? I mean, verse 3 seems to lay out the kind of the groundwork on why you have all of this covering and uncovering and things of this. There's a manifestation of submission and headship that kind of falls back onto verse 3. Because if you took verse 3 out and just read verse 2, and I praise you because you remember me and everything and hold firmly to the traditions just as I delivered them to you. Every man who has something on his head while praying and prophesying, I would have, if he'd taken verse 3 out, I would have assumed traditions in verse 2 is the traditions of praying and prophesying with your head covered. But you have verse 3 in there. And so you have to look at the passage and how he brings it into focus here. Like what Tom was saying here, he has this sort of hierarchy. Because he brings it out. Every man has this. God is ahead of this. Christ is ahead of this. Man is ahead of this. Woman is ahead of this. And then I think what he does is he tries to sort of, not say apply it, but shows how it should be in an applicable form in a social setting when you have men and women, especially when they're doing something, not so much they're outdoor cooking. This is in the context of praying and prophesying. So when you're doing something, you know, before the Lord, this is how there should be a representative response of that type of hierarchy, from what I'm gathering from verse 3. Because to me, verse 3 sets the tone for the rest of it, because it doesn't make sense on why he would say that and then just kind of launch into verse 4.
Well, again,
so we have to draw from it. Go ahead.
Again, verse 3, I think, with the idea of the divine order, in other words, you pointed out, you know, verse 2 speaks of traditions. Verse 3 begins with but. In other words, he's not talking about tradition there, verse 3. You know, he's talking about, again, this is a divine order. This is from God. You know, right. Verse 2, he's speaking with tradition. Verse 3 is a change.
Yeah, I mean, whatever traditions he's talking about in verse 2, obviously, when he jumps into 3 on down, my impression is that it's part of this tradition thing in verse 2. Am I mentioning?
I that's what I'm saying, is it's different. In other words, he's saying the but, right? He's saying, I praise you because you remember me and everything, and all prelates and tradition just to deliver them to you. Okay, whatever that was that he previously said, maybe in the other chapters. But verse 3, but I want you to understand that Christ is the head of every man. That's not a tradition. In other words, this is divine order that he's bringing up now.
Right. And my point is that if tradition is referring back to chapters 8, 9, and 10, there really aren't any traditions in that weaker, strong brook, if that's the case, number one. But number two, he could be arguing for this as being traditions, but he set the table first with the principle on why the tradition in verse 4 on down is the way it is because of, I mean, think of why this tradition is there. We didn't pull it out of a bag. It's got this as its premise, verse 3. That could be an argument as well. Tom makes a good point. Paul doesn't really, you know, he just praises them because they hold firmly to the traditions in this plural that he's talking about. So he could be just covering the waterfront. I mean, look, you guys are doing a good job when it comes to these, you know, these kind of things I set down in churches. And y'all are doing a great job. You remember me and everything, and you're holding firmly to the tradition. So those traditions could be wider than just what he's talking about here. But it could encapsulate this aspect here, because you could see how this could be something that could go off the rails, get misinterpreted. It's like, no, this is what we do in church. This is what we do in church. Women come, they do this. Men come, they do that. You know, you don't do this. If you do this, you got to do it this way. If you don't, you do it this way. I can see how that could be something that he's kind of putting some of the, not just telling them what the tradition is, but trying to tell them why there's that tradition. In other words, trying to give them some logic, common sense, theological sense on why we have that. Verse 3 is the theological premise for that, from, I think, what Paul's going to try to argue for the rest of 4 through 10. But yeah, but Todd's point is well taken, is that traditions is broad and it could be more than that. Anybody on Zoom have any comments?
Hey, Mark.
Hey.
What? Am I missing exactly like what the question is?
Yeah, I also got a text from somebody wanting to hear the question again, so Zach's going to repeat it loudly. It's the verse 4 thing. I think your question was, Zach, correct me, is that he didn't quite understand the transition from verses 2 and 3 to verse 4. Because I think he was thinking verses 2 and 3 is of one kind of topic, and then all of a sudden he jumps into the middle.
It seems like, but then it could be the same topic. It just kind of maybe shifts the direction. I mean, I don't know. Just
yeah. So Zach's question basically was that, why that, you know, whether change up or whatever in verse 4.
Can I give my opinion?
You're up.
Well, like you said, Mark, verse 3 is setting up everything that follows. For instance, in verse 4, he talks about a man covers his head while he's praying and prophesying he dishonors his head. So who's he talking about? Well, it tells you in verse 3, his head is Christ. That's who he's dishonoring if he does that. But a woman, if she prays with her head the opposite, uncovered, she's dishonoring her head, or her head is her husband. So this passage, the real point he's trying to make with the woman here, you see in verse 10, he says, for this cause the woman ought to have power in her head. Power means authority. On her head because of the angels. Well, the angels he's referring to are not the holy angels, it's demons.
Demons.
Okay. So the significance of this is that it signifies that she's not rebelling against the covering of her head, which is her husband. She's showing that authority on her head because that's her protection from the demon powers. That's our protection, all of us, you know, our protection, the demon powers is our submission to Christ. But with the wife, it's significant for her to be in submission to her husband. It's not a correlating passage at all, but it gives you a little bit of an idea of what he's talking about with the woman's head covering. So just let me read to you a few verses from Deuteronomy chapter 21. He says, when you go forth to war against your enemies, and the Lord your God has delivered them into your hands, and you have taken them captive, you see among them, the captives, a beautiful woman, and you have a desire in her that you would have her to thy wife. And shalt thou bring her home to your house, and she shall shave her head and pare her nails. And she shall put the raiment of her captivity from off her. And she shall remain in your house and bewail her father and mother a full month. And after that, thou shalt go in unto her and be her husband, and she shall be your wife. And if it shall be, if thou have no delight in her, then shalt thou let her go whither she will, but thou shalt not sell her at all for money. Thou shalt not make merchandise of her because you humbled her by having laid with her, basically. But the point here is back in verse 12 when he talks about this captive girl. When you bring her, she's to shave her head, pair of nails. Well, the shaving of the head is signifying the former authority. Like in verse 13, she's bewailing her mother and father for a full month. She's to mourn over what is essentially now her lost past life and the loss of her people, her parents, so forth. And with the shaving of her head signifies that that previous authority has been removed. She's now under the authority of this man. So that's kind of like the significance of the covering of the head. That's what that means. It's just a symbol, really, in this respect, physically, of the spiritual reality that the husband is her head. And she is, again, the whole point is, he says in verse, what is it, 5? He says that, you know, to uncover her head is to dishonor her head, which is her husband. So she's, you know, it's in an effort to, again, honor him, to show her submission to him, that she's under his authority. And that is for her own good, for protection from the angels, the devils.
Interesting there. What's that passage in Deuteronomy? What's the name of it? Was it 21?
Deuteronomy 21 starts in verse 10. The more important verses are 12 and 13, I believe.
Got it.
But it just... You know, they don't really correlate. It's just that it just shows the shaving of the head, and you get a picture of what it's symbolizing there. Which, of course, if you read through this in 1 Corinthians, that's the point Paul's making.
Yeah.
You know, honoring the man, honoring his head by keeping his head not covered, but for the woman, it does the opposite. It works the opposite. It's dishonoring to her head, which is her husband, if she doesn't cover her head. And all that is, again, for honoring her authority. That's why Zach, he begins this way in verse 3. He's telling you who the heads are. You know, the hierarchy, right? And he does that because when he's talking about, if he doesn't do that and he starts talking about honoring and dishonoring your head, there could be some confusion as to what is he talking about.
It's interesting in verse 7, a man ought not to have his head covered since he is the image and glory of God. It's interesting since he gives this argument, since he is the image and glory of God. He doesn't quite use that argument for the woman. Because he says for the woman, she's the glory of man. Now,
yes,
she's obviously human. And she's, you know, as he's going to say in verse 11, you know, how a woman is not independent of man. Man is not independent of woman. The woman originates from the man, but the man has his birth through the woman. All of them originate from God. So he's making the argument that, yeah, you're going to need one another. You can't have one without the other. So they're interdependent.
Yes. It's not that one is better than the other, right. But God did establish authority. He did establish a hierarchy, which he tells you very clearly what that is in verse 3.
Yeah.
Which sets up everything that follows, because, you know, if you're going to honor your head, or you want to make sure you don't dishonor your head, you have to know who that is.
Yeah.
And so since he makes it clear, I mean, he just flat out states it. It's not that Christ isn't the head of the woman. Of course he is. Head over all things in heaven and earth. But the way that the Lord made it here on the earth, the man, her husband, is her direct authority.
Now, something else.
By God's design. That's his command, not ours. I mean, Paul didn't make that up.
Something else you have to do when you interpret this section here, and I'll use the word head and use the word cranium so that you know the difference between the two that Gary was talking about. When he talks about, for if a woman does not cover her head, well, that's not cover her head being her husband, that's her cranium. You know, he goes and he says, then she, you know, disgraces her head. Well, is it disgracing her cranium or is it disgracing her husband? So you got to understand he's going to use head in both of those kind of senses here, you know. He's using it right here in verse 6. If a woman does not cover her head, he's not talking about a woman's got to go out there and find her husband and try to cover him. That wouldn't make sense. It's her cranium he's talking about. But he uses the word head. I don't even know if they had a Greek word for cranium back then. But you understand what I'm saying with cranium. It's the 7-pound ball that sits over the shoulders. Okay? But here, many times that word head, and the commentators will go back and forth on whether they're talking about the cranium, or they're talking about, well, that's a disgrace to her cranium. It's like, no, if it's a disgrace to her cranium, it would be a disgrace to her. You don't have to just say, well, my cranium is being disgraced. but the rest of me's not kind of thing. It's probably her head, her man, her husband kind of thing. But Paul didn't get in the weeds with that. He just kind of mentions it and moves on, kind of type of thing.
Middle verse, but it is just Christ 6, verse 6. Disgraceful for a woman to have her hair cut off or her head shaved. So her head cut off. What are we talking about, length now? Because then it says, or her head shaved. So we know bald. I don't think shaved means bald. So the previous, her hair cut off. So is that designating a length? Because what's the difference between hair cut off and her hair being shaved? Except that her hair cut would have to designate a length, where her hair shaved means that you've taken a blade and you've gone down to the,
okay, wait,
the scalp.
Link how?
I don't know. What do you mean by it? It says, for a woman to have her hair cut off.
What verse are you talking about? So we can know.
Middle verse 6.
6.
For her hair to cut off or her head shaved. So he's saying, so or her head shaved, all right, completely. But both are disgraced, as you'll want to say. But her hair cut off, what, I mean, why don't you just say her hair cut off or her hair shaved? Why is he saying her hair cut off or her head shaved?
Okay.
Well, I'm asking, what does that mean? The hair cut off means a length, designating a length of hair?
Well, yeah, first of all, think of verse 6. He starts off with the premise where if a woman does not cover her head, remember,
cranium.
He's been talking about this whole idea, cranium, does not cover her cranium. Because he's been talking about how it's a disgrace if man covers his head, a woman doesn't cover her head, yada, yada, yada. So now he's going to argue, take it from the opposite perspective. For if a woman does not cover her head, let's work with that. She's not going to cover her head. Okay, she's not going to cover her cranium, and she's going to pray and prophesy. Then the only people that can pray and prophesy with a head uncovered are people that don't have any hair. Now, that's kind of the argument he's arguing for. Let her have her hair cut off. In other words, basically, let her go transgender. Uh-oh. In other words, men don't have their hair long. Men don't have their head covered. So if she's going to represent that uncovering and be in that kind of category, well, then you're acting the part of a man. The part of a man doesn't have hair like that. And so you're going to have to look the part, which I don't think he's telling them to do that. I think what he's doing, he's just trying to show them, this is, if you fall into this category, you want to get in that category and have your head with that's not covered, well, then you're going to have to look like a man. Because those are the only people in that category that can pray and prophesy in that kind of state. And you want to be in that state, well, then you're going to have to look like a man. You can't go in there and be an uncovered. I think that's what he's trying to argue here in verse 6. Because he says it's a disgrace. And he says, notice, but if it's disgraceful for a woman to have her hair cut off, that's a premise that everybody probably would argue. It is. And then he says, or her head shaved, then guess what, guys? Guess what, girls? You got to cover your head. See, that's the whole point of verse 6. Let her cover her head. Now he's going to argue for this here in the verse 7, for a man ought not to have his head cut. See, here's the same thing on why he doesn't have a head cover. See, this verse 6 is the argument from the other side of why the woman should, because if you don't, you're going to have to fall into the category of a man, look like a man, pray and prophesy like a man. Oh, it's a disgrace to do that? Well, then guess what? Cover your head and get out of the category. I think that's what he's trying to say in verse 6. Verse 7, it's the same thing for the man, though, but it's from a different perspective. For a man ought not to have his head covered, since he is the image and glory of God. That's a very simple one. They shouldn't wear the cover.
So covering in verse 7, though, we're distinctly signifying a garment, something on your head, not your hair.
Correct.
Okay.
I would think so.
Correct.
That's interesting, especially in our culture with transgenderism. I've never thought about this. 1 Corinthians 11. But trying to switch over to a different gender in light of this. It says in verse 7, which I love, that the woman is the glory of man. Now, let me just kind of meditate on that a little bit. When you think of the glory of God, the glory of Christ, when you look at that and you see glory, what you're seeing, the word glory is like the word doxa, Greek word. It means weight, it means value, it means beauty. Majesty. I mean, what a compliment that for, this ought to be true for every man, that they should be able to say, you know, we say the fairer sex. In other words, if you want to see humanity and you want to see the beauty of humanity, get a woman. That's humanity. You want to see the beauty of a man, it's going to be in the woman. And course. That's how we see women. That's how men should see women. There's not an ugly woman on the planet. Shouldn't ever be thought of that way. It's like they represent men in the mankind's beauty. Because he calls them, the woman is the glory of man. Now, man, he doesn't originate from the woman. Man came from the dust of the earth. Woman didn't come from dust of the earth. Woman came from man. And so he's going to make this argument, makes it in 1 Timothy 2, that they come, they have different roles, different functions. They have different glories in that sense. Man does what? He's the image and the glory of God. So we reflect that as men. Doesn't mean a woman doesn't have any kind of image or glory of God. Of course she does. But it's a derivative sense that she was brought into existence because she is going to, as he says here, verse 9, for indeed man was not created for the woman's sake, but the woman for the man's sake. And so this whole idea of her role and how she was created, you know, to complement, in other words, if you had a planet of nothing but women, according to God, it would not make sense. He totally, no, it's not why they're here. I didn't make them all for women. He didn't make man and he hadn't made woman yet. He made woman as man was already here, and that's how you can see how she fits, coming from his side, not from the ground. And you can see how Paul will argue for that later on in 1 Timothy 2, but you can also see it in Genesis, but you see some of it here. And this whole idea of the woman is the glory of man, and why? Women want to become men, and men want to, it's like, this is insane. This, you can see this here. It's like, this is unbelievable. You know, it's like, once again, a man wanting to become a woman says something about what he's the glory of, and he's the glory of Christ. It's a, in my body, I want to deface it because I refuse to glorify my head, Jesus Christ. And that's quite a mistake when you think about it from 1 Corinthians 11. But anyway, this verse 10 is a, like Gary said, because of the angels. Now that makes sense, since the angels mean demons. But you know, I got to tell you, Gary, in chapter 10, he uses the word demons. I mean, so it's not like he's afraid to use the word, you know, the Greek word for demons. He could have put demons there, but he puts angels. Now, whether it's good angels, but the angels can also mean messengers. Is it broader than that? Is he meaning angels in the sense of the spectrum of good and bad? It could be that broad, but just says angels in general. And he means good and bad. And we understand how the bad would fit in here. I don't know why. But it's like,
yeah.
He didn't get into the specifics, though.
It's,
you know,
used, the same word is used interchangeable for demons and holy angels.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that.
So, yeah, all throughout it. So it kind of, you know, and you can tell, like, for instance, it'll mention an angel coming down from heaven and doing something you can tell that is a holy activity. You know that's a holy angel. Then it describes multiple occasions of an angel falling from heaven and then doing something evil.
Oh, you mean the book of Revelation? Oh, yeah. Yes. Okay, yeah.
So you can see the word, the same word used, but yet the context of how it's used, you can tell what they are.
Oh, that's true. I forgot about the book of Revelation, but using those words.
Yeah,
in that sense.
And okay. The thing about this, though, headship and authority is terribly important when it comes to that very thing with, like, demonic issues. Have somebody get demons or just rebel against God. That's all you have to do. So, rebelling against God's authority is just, you know, the direct way to get demon problems. You know, when you walk, you know, why are the commandments? You know, why is it, how is this for her good? He's telling them this is her good, for her good, because of the angels. Because they're going to take advantage of everyone who steps outside of God's authority. They do that.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, Mark, you've gone through this. So when you deal with somebody who's got demon problems, you have to start working with them in a way to find out how did they get into this. Yeah. Because usually those are sins that have to be made known. They're, as Conrad would refer to it, as legal grounds for that demon to be there. Yeah. And until you deal with that, and that sin is repented of, you cannot get rid of the demons.
Yeah.
Mark, that has to happen.
That's a good point. Yeah.
In verse 9, he says that neither was a man created for the woman, but for the woman for the man. Hey, John, Tom, it's King James. 10, and up there in 10 in the King James, says on the King James, it says, for this cause. Now, the word cause is referring to the previous comment about what he's saying in verse 9, and then he says that the woman ought to have power on her head because of the angels. But there's a symbol of authority. word, the word power and the word symbol of authority being equal here? I'm just trying to see if it doesn't read right in both versions. I don't know.
Well, when you have something italicized, I know the New American Standard, you don't have Greek behind it.
Okay.
They're supplying the English to make the connection in Greek. So you will have Greek on behind the word, therefore the woman ought to have authority on her head because of the angels, or power. And that word for power, I'm not quite sure what the Greek, whether it's dunamis, but there's another word for it.
So the question is, what are we, back to Gary a little bit, what are we demonstrating to the angels then because of the angels? So are we demonstrating the structure or who has authority? I mean,
It's just obedience, submission.
Order. That's it. There's order, orderliness, you know.
Yeah, well, I mean, if we obey and submit, then order's naturally there.
Right. That's true. It's interesting, he turns and gets to verse 11, and he sort of moves away from the dependence of the woman on the man, in the sense of, as he says, verse 8, man does not originate from woman, woman from man. So you see that woman comes from man, and then you see the purpose in verse 9, man wasn't created for the woman, woman was created for man. And then you see, so the woman ought to have a symbol of authority on her head because of the angels. And then he moves back to the middle, and he gets to verse 11, and says, however, in the Lord, neither is woman independent of man, nor man is independent of woman. So, you know, once again, it kind of moves toward a middle shift here, where he says in verse 12, for as the woman originates from the man, now here comes the shift to the middle, so also the man has his birth through the woman. Don't ever get to planet Earth unless you have a woman in your future. And he says, and all things originate from God, which brings everything. Now, it's interesting, he gets into verse 13 here, and he kind of gets out of his argument here, but now he's just appealing now to them in almost like common sense. Judge for yourselves, and you see that, it's like, you should be able to surmise this on your own. Apart from this up here, I've just been saying to you, Corinthians, is it proper for a woman to pray to God with her head uncovered? You tell me. See, this is the purpose of this up here. This is why he's bringing it to kind of a conclusion in verse 13, which is, what's proper? See, is it proper? And once again, there's that demeanor of what they're doing in a social context. In other words, it's not proper for a woman to pray to God with her head uncovered. That's the whole point he's trying to make. You judge, you tell me. Well, they should have said, well, yeah, kind of like common sense, almost like a rhetorical question, you see. And then he goes, it's not just judge for yourself. Does not even nature itself, but you should have it in the sense of yourselves and what's proper. But even nature itself, if you look at nature itself, teach you that if a man has long hair, it's a dishonor to him. But if a woman has long hair, it is a glory to her. Now, it's interesting here, as he says this, now he's going to talk about the hair as a cover. Here he's talking about having her head covered. Here now he's going to talk about her hair as a cover. Then he says, does not even nature itself teach you that if a man has long hair, it's a dishonor to him? Now, he's never mentioned men having long hair up here. He's just mentioned how man is the, as he says, is the glory of Christ up here in verse 3. But he also says, right here in verse 7, since he is the image and glory of God. But he hasn't never said anything about man having long hair and it being a dishonor. And of course, women having long hair, it's a glory to her. And maybe this is going to be, once again, one of those arguments for her hair not being cut for the whole point.
Mark, on that, at that point, on verse 15, you know, her hair is given to her for a covering. So it says she's to have her head covered. So her long hair is given to her for a covering. That's part of the divine order, because it comes from creation. That's the way God has made us. And it's interesting because the scriptures obviously don't deal with what I'm about to say technically. But, you know, we can look in our history and the 60s, the 70s, when feminism started really, you know, the next wave, the new wave, and all these different waves of feminism. That's when we begin, like you said, you talked a few minutes ago about the women cutting their hair. and to look like men. And that, we see that constantly now. I mean, I was at the state capitol yesterday and preaching, and you know, there were women trying to look like men with their short hair. And, you know, you see that. And I think in a sense that has to do with what Paul is saying there about, you know, even nature itself tells you that, because this is the way God made us, and he has this divine order that has been set up. And so, yeah, you look, what's going on is against God. It's a rebellion. You know, Gary mentioned that earlier. You know, what does it take to get a demon? Well, rebel against God. What do we see? This you know, movement that's turned into this alphabet soup, and it's a rebellion against God. And what are they doing? Well, they cut their hair. They want to look like a man. They want to be a man, so on and so forth. So it's you know, if they're not, obviously, if they were married to a man, it would be dishonoring to him, you know, because yeah. Then it's making him look like as if he's married to a man. And I don't think it's talking about feminine short hair. I think when people talk about the issue of length, I think we can get into legalism on length and things like this. It's got to be, you know, to the collar or whatever. I don't think that's it. I think it has a distinct, I want to look like a man attitude, right? Yeah. Right?
I want to be butch. Right.
Yeah, you know the attitude. You see it at Walmart all the time now.
It's more than the hair, usually. It's a lot of
yeah, them. Yeah, right. You're right. And which right. The scriptures speak to that as well.
Right.
But again, I think, you know, we don't have to necessarily, you know, be concerned as much like the idea of length, saying, well, this, you know, this length, that length. I think it has so much to do with the heart attitude.
Right.
I'm in rebellion. I hate God. And I'm going to cut my hair. I want to look like a man. I want to be a man. You know, I identify as a man. You know, and so on and so forth. That's what we're hearing constantly now.
It's true.
Well, that's just the irony. They despise men, but then they want to be like men.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so we drop back, and it's going to be hard to do. Drop back and look at this forest here and draw some applications from the forest in the sense of, okay, head coverings, not head coverings, originations, glory of Christ, glory of man. Paul sums up what he says in verse 16, but if one is inclined to be contentious, we have no other practice, nor have the churches of God. See, that word practice, I translate back to traditions. In other words, I don't have a different practice. I'm not just, you know, singling you out, Corinthians, and giving you these instructions on just y'all. And I do something different in Thessalonica. But nor have the churches of God. I'm giving this across the board here, right? And so you can see when he says we have no other practice, this idea of practice or traditions or whatever else he might be trying to home in on with this whole idea. And he's trying to, I think, try to give some rhyme and reason for the covering of heads, for the non-covering of heads, trying to give some principles for it in verse 3. Also trying to give some principles for it in verse 10 when it comes to angels and things of this sort. And then trying to get them to use some common sense here where he says, judge for yourself and look, nature itself. Even this, I mean, just even in the pagan world, in other words, when you kind of look on the pagan world, look at the guys and look at the girls. Which ones have long hairs and which ones have short hair? You should be able to say, look, man, even among them they know these things. You know, and so once again, he's not so much getting into the specific theology of Genesis and kind of really getting into all the weeds with that as much as he's trying to appeal to them about practice in verse 16, which undoubtedly the Corinthians were in the I'm not saying habit or were kind of letting slide this whole idea of women praying and prophesying without head coverings, and it was obviously a distraction. For anybody else, they would look at it and say, oh, sister so-and-so is here and she don't have her head cut, you know. And once again, they're not worshiping, they're not praying, they're not prophesying as they should or whatever, simply because it's a distraction. It draws attention to itself that she doesn't fit the categories of what it means to be a woman and what it means to be a woman in a place of worship, just as it would be a woman at home or anything like this. And obviously, you can't wear a head covering 24/7. Got to take a shower, got to take a bath. You get that. But in places where you're going to be addressing God and things of this sort and brethren. He says this has to represent that the decorum, the dress that you wear, so to say, how you present yourself, should be something that doesn't fly in the face of nature and is proper among men. That's why I use the word proper in verse 13 and nature in verse 14. So that everything's done in an orderly kind of way, in a sensible kind of way. So that the angels, whether in verse 10, good, bad, or whatever, don't get involved and you have some sort of spiritual dimension. Like I think Gary brought up some good things. If you're inclined to be contentious in verse 16, then you're inclined to be rebellious in verse 10. Because to have that as an edge, well, I'm going to do my own thing. Well, I'm going to make a statement. I'm going to do that. Yeah, you're going to make a statement, all right. And you're going to draw, it says in verse 10, you're going to draw the attraction of some unwanted spirits when you do that. Oh, yeah, you'll get attention, all right. You'll get their attention. And you sure you want to go down that road in the realm? Yeah. So he didn't develop that. He just says it and then moves on. I think he's just not trying to spend a lot of time there, but he's trying to make the point here. Probably maybe a question they had in their letter.
Mark, also, as far as like, you know, I could see where it would apply also in public space, you know, everywhere. Right. In other words, as a Christian, that's what you're showing.
Right.
Which, again, where would you see this when he says, you know, you see it out in nature, right? You see other people, right? In public, this is the way it is. And so I'm not etched in stone on this idea that it's the hair, but it just seems to me like the head covering would be the hair because it goes with the woman where she goes.
Yeah,
you know, that's true. In worship or in public, whatever, yeah. And she's showing by that she's under the authority of her husband.
Yeah. Yeah, in verse 15, but if a woman has long hair, it's a glory to her. And he's making that as a statement, like a rhetorical statement. In other words, it's a truism. A woman who has long hair is a glory to her. Her hair is her glory. Now, whether that translates into it's her covering, because my basic question in this whole section, which Paul didn't address, why does she have to have the head covered in the first place? Why does it have to be covered? The man doesn't have to be covered. God. And he says it because he's the image and glory of God. But is the know that the covering has part to do with her relationship with her man, but it's why is that the way to represent her glory of the man? Is it because they're fallen? And it's like you have your head covered, you know, when you go into execution, God, it's like it's a symbol of the fallenness of man. And so that while it's the glory, she's the, you know, created for his glory. When you appear before God, man's glory has been tainted. And so the covering represents the taintedness. Look, I'm drawing straws here. I got nothing in the text. I'm just kind of thinking outside the box on why the necessity for the covering for the woman. I mean, could have been something else that she could have done to represent that, or it had to be that because it showed a sign of shame. Because sometimes you see in the Old Testament, they would cover a man's head and they would bring him, you know, someplace to be executed or something. Gary.
Yeah, I don't know the exact reason for that, but notice the context here that you see in verse 4, talking about if a man is praying or prophesying having his head covered. Doesn't mean he can't wear a hat, but if he's praying or prophesying, he's not to have his head covered. In verse 5, it's the woman when she's praying or prophesying. So obviously these are spiritual activities, and the only way I can look at that, and you know, whether I'm right or wrong, I don't really know for sure. It's just an opinion. But given the context there, I just think it's for whatever reason, it pleases the Lord to see that. Yeah. As we approach to Him. There's a certain way always He wants us to approach to Him.
True. Right.
And it's signifying, first of all, man not to have his head covered. Why? Because He is the authority on the earth in that respect. And he shouldn't be submitting. I mean, he is to the Lord, of course, but, you know, not to the woman. It's, you know, he's on the earth even when he's praying and prophesying. He's, you know, he's basically, I guess, designating his authority is the only way to put it that I can think of, unless somebody's got a better term. But in the exact opposite for the woman. It's just a matter of approach to the Lord. And again, it does have a spiritual context because obviously it's spiritual eyes, although we see it, but really the regard, you know, because it's prayer and prophesying, it would be the Lord's eyes seeing it, but also, you know, the rebellion where the devil sees it. By the way, the word angels there in verse 10 is the exact same word in 2 Corinthians 12 when Paul's talking about the thorn in the flesh. A messenger of Satan, the word messenger is the exact same word.
Messenger, same Greek word. Angel of Satan. Okay, good. There you go.
Yeah, so okay. That's the exact same word. So there that's what I mean. It's used interchangeably, whether it's, you know, devils or
right.
or holy angels. Context. It just depends on the context that's used.
Right, makes sense.
But again, obviously, well, the devils are watching it too. You know, so in the spiritual realm, obviously, is where it has its biggest significance. Which I don't know how I can, you know, anybody, at least I can't, you know, to really explain that other than it's set forth, you know, here, you know, through Paul, that this is what the Lord wants us to do.
Yeah.
I don't know why it matters, but,
yeah,
you know, I can't like just sit here and say, you know, other than the Lord said so, I can't tell you necessarily why that, you know, why would that matter? Because he looks at our hearts, right? He knows our hearts.
Well, Tom brings up a good point. When you have long hair, it's not an artificial cover. It's built into your body to yes. have that covering versus yeah. an artificial one where I've got to go put it on, I've got to take it off, put it on, take it off. But you don't put on and take off long hair. I mean, this isn't a wig he's arguing for. But at the same time, it's there permanently, which begs the question also that, you know, before the Lord, because this is all stuff before the Lord, it, you know, here's man. He's the image and glory of God. He appears before God with his head uncovered to represent me. It's like he's in a representative state here. That's why he appears in this uncovered state. Those who are covered have a derivative authority from their head. So it represents derivation. In other words, her head being, her cranium being covered, whether through long hair or covering, shows a derivative authority that she gets from man, husband, whatever. So that, you know, she appears before God. She recognizes her place in that hierarchy there. And the covering represents that before the Lord. And that's a sign of respect on how she was made. She recognizes it, and she worships the Lord within that sphere of respect. That's why, if you look at that man who mutilated himself, in, he's called Rachel Levine. If they... Secretary of, I can't remember.
Yeah, Assistant Secretary of Health.
I mean, yeah, you look at that, of course, as a sinner, you know, under the wrath of God, but you look at what he has tried to do, and you know, when you look at him, the first thing you think about, is the first, nobody looks at him and says, hey, now that's a woman. Nobody thinks that. They know he's a man trying to be something else. You can't help but doing that. He's a poor, I mean, he's one ugly woman. I mean, because he was a man, and he tries to become a woman. It's not going to happen. I don't know. They try to pass off these women in beauty contests to try to dress up like women, whatever. Whatever you do at the end of the day, we know you're a man. And whatever you try to say as a glory that's supposed to be for men, it's not a glory for men. It's a shame. It's an insult to men because what you've done, you try to say, I'm going to destroy this category, and I'm going to get in this category, and I'm going to make it so that I'm the glory of a man. And it's impossible for them to do that. That's when a woman goes into a man's category, it's impossible for them to be in that position where they're going to be looked upon as, this is a real man. You're not a real man. I'm sorry. You're just not. God has made you this, and there's no way you can cross over the barrier and be something different.
Just real quick, I had a guy come in with a dress, documented breasts, hairstyle, and everything. And I said, you're going to be, we're going to put you in an outfit, so, because you're going to be spending your time with the men. Because I asked him, I said, do you still have your sex organ? He said, yes. And I said, well, you'll be incarcerated with the men. He started making, he goes, well, I don't want to hold my attorney. I said, you can tell your attorney all you want. As far as you're in here, you'll be spending your time with the male cells, not with the women's cells.
But God, in his wisdom, has put in the signature in every cell in every chromosome, XY or XX. Mm-hmm. We know that. 100 years ago, you wouldn't have known that, but we know that. So we know going in, you can change yourself to look unbelievable. As a woman kind of thing, but it's like, sorry, bro, you have XY chromosomes. You are a man. However you want to do it, you've defaced yourself. And you're making a statement to your, not cranium, to your head, Christ, by saying, I reject you. I don't want to glorify you. See, by destroying who I am in relation to you, because I don't want to represent you, and I don't want to glorify you as being the image and glory of Jesus Christ. I'm going to destroy myself. And the woman can do that when it comes to her head, not cranium, but her head, and do that toward men and say, I'm going to change the categories. All you do is destroy yourself in the glory that you're called to be, in the relationship that you're called to have, you know, with men. Anybody else? Anybody else on Zoom? Or have I lost anybody? Or are you just eating the popcorn? Come on.
Well, there's already reports coming out, and I guess this thing's been around long enough now where the reports are coming back about the regret, the stories now, the testimonies of the people that have, I guess, have done it. The regret stories are now coming out.
There's a bunch of documentaries.
Yeah.
Go to A&E and ask for the documentary. They shut them down. They wouldn't allow them to.
Oh, really?
Oh, testimony after testimony after testimony of people who transitioned and now regret it, have a problem. Yeah. But they won't let them testify.
Right.
They won't let them put it on the air because they want to have only one narrative that this is the thing.
Well, it's like saying abortion. They don't want anybody post-abortionist to realize what's before, what's happened to testify.
And they're going to control the dictionary. It's called gender affirming. It's called mutilation affirming. It's not gender affirming. See, you're going to fight the dictionary on that, and then they're going to nail you for hate crimes, mm-hmm. which is, I think it's already a law in Michigan that it's a hate crime if you don't call somebody by their pronouns. Mm-hmm. So this Rachel Levine, Rachel, it's not Rachel anymore. It's whatever his real name was. But it's like, I'm going to use the he pronoun. So I would get, charged up for a hate crime saying, well, she goes by a she and you keep calling him a he. You're doing it because you hate him. No, I'm doing it because it's reality. I'm not going to play. I have team at the Mad Hatter Analysis Wonderland. I'm going to call them for what they really are. He's a man. He's deluded, and you're playing along with the delusion, and yet you expect me to play along. I can't do that as a Christian. I am feet firmly planted in reality. Well, I tell you about God, I tell you about judgment, the common things of this sort. I'm telling you, this man's a man. Yet he's mutilated himself. He wants to doll up and call him something else. It's like, sorry. I mean, and there's going to be repercussions because they're going to call that hate. You got to get used to it. That's what's going to take place. You might have encountered some of it at the state capitol over there. So. But anybody else on
this? Give a moment to a reprobate mind.
Yeah, that's true.
Is any of this relation to when it offends the brethren, like with the meat eating meat? If it's the custom of wearing the coverings, that if it would offend any of the brethren, wearing the customs, that you would go ahead and do that?
Not quite sure on that, Fred. I mean, what you're asking about, whether, because like here with Paul in verse 16, I mean, he says if anyone's inclined to be contentious in the sense of trying to, I'm assuming, bow up and not want to practice what he's talking about here, whether it's these traditions or what, when it comes to public worship and prophesying and praying, that he would look upon this as being a sin of a social order for sure. But it'd be something like he says in verse 13 and 14 that this is one of the apologetics he's using. He used the theological argument in verses 4 through 12. Now he's using just common sense practically in 13 and 14.
It seems like the one who's offended is not men, but you are offending God here. Is the one who's offended.
Right.
In this.
Right.
Well, I'm sure you're associated with some of the churches, Mark, because you're out of scope to have it. I know I went to a church for 12 years that practiced head coverings. There was some pretty lively debate about this discussion over and over and over. I guess John's taking the approach up there as far as people coming in not wearing a head covering that is accepted or whatever. But the members, the women, all wear head coverings, and so. I guess what Fred's asking is there, you can't be a member there unless you would have more of the view of the head covering you. So John will explain all that. He's the person gets that far with it. I don't know what he's touching on, but that was a little bit what he's touching on, actual head coverings.
Now, one question you will get, it's already come up. In verse 14, what's the definition of long hair on a man? I honestly say Ron's got short hair.
Well, Frank certainly was a challenge to that question many years ago.
But once again, is it long in the eyes of the beholder or long in the eyes of the grower of the hair? Hmm. Because on one hand, you took a Nazirite vow, you never cut your hair. That was part of the Nazirite vow. He lost his power because he grew his hair. So it's not necessarily the man can grow his hair, it's like a woman grows her hair. The issue is why you're growing the hair. If you're growing the hair and it's this narcissistic kind of angle to it, it doesn't matter. You can have it touching your ears. If you think it's long, you're in rebellion because of the heart attitude of why you're growing, whatever you're growing. But for a Nazirite to grow it, and he had to follow strict rules of, you know, staying from wine and growing his hair. It's a whole different context and mentality on why he's doing that. And that's become something totally different. And you're not just sitting there looking at hair length and then trying to size up and say anything over 6 inches, anything over 12 inches, if you can put it in a ponytail. All of that's irrelevant. You're never going to find that in the text. But it's why you're growing the hair in the first place to do whatever you're doing with it. And that's everything. And now a person can lie and say, well, I'm just growing because this is the God knows your heart. God knows why you're growing your hair and whatever you're doing with your hair. That's the name. Or a woman in the opposite direction, cutting it short or whatever. You know, if you're going to say, oh, well, it's summertime and it's hot, whatever else. And that might be some good utilitarian reasons. But the real question is, does God want you to cut your hair? Just like for the man, does God want you to grow your hair? I'd ask the same question in the opposite sense to the man as to the woman. So quit giving me the practical reasons, and you have to look at the biblical ones, where you go before the Lord and say, Lord, what would you have me to do with my hair? Now, think about that. It makes you first submit your glamour unto the Lord instead of unto your neighbors and what everybody else thinks on how you should look and wear your hair and things of that sort. Stop. Lord, how would you have me to look so that I would look category I'm supposed to fit in? So I look feminine or I look masculine. What would you have me to do in order for these things to take place? And that's huge. I don't ask the culture for these things. I don't go to the, you know, cosmopolitan magazines to get ideas. It's just, what would you have? And I'm not saying you have to look the worst you can be, or just, you know, don't do anything. It's like, you want to be, you know, you beautify yourself as much as, you know, it's within the realm of being feminine. But at the same time, like he says in 1 Timothy 2, I'm not caught up with the putting on dresses and the putting on, the gold and all this if I'm a woman. So that it's all about how I look. Because if that's the case, I'm starting off on a narcissistic stage instead of before the Lord. Good stuff. Thanks, Zach. I don't know if we answered the question on that. But anybody else on this? This is a hard section to interpret if you expect that. The hard thing for me was when he was talking about head as cranium and head as the authority of the person above them, whether it's Christ above men or men above, or just making sure you keep the heads and the craniums separate for one. Some things about angels here, you know, that makes it kind of difficult here. Some things when he appeals to common sense in nature itself. But you see where he's going, because he doesn't want, you know, we don't have this any kind of practice along what you're trying to do here. He wants a decorum in a public setting, especially in church when they're praying and prophesying, that is reflective of categories of femininity and masculinity. Now, think about that. In our culture, I mean, that's going out the window. It's androgynous across the board. And so to have those categories here, this is assumed in 1 Corinthians 11. He's not arguing for them. He's assuming them. That's how he argues from them. And so it's like those categories have already been, you know, shot to the wind in our everyday culture.
It will cause church, it will cause Christians to obviously be different. So it really will. And length of hair of the man, I still don't know really what it is. I know that, you know, when I got out of the army, I let my hair grow again, and I had it really long. long up at Natchitoches, but I was attending church, that New Testament up there with Dr. Cook and Dr. Campbell. You know, those people, they were very, very, I think they were very loving toward me and charitable and long-suffering with me. And I even went to Dr. Campbell and talked to him about it. You know, he was convinced. He told me, he said, you know, well, Tom, you know, it ain't a problem for praying people. You know, in other words, he said it didn't bother them.
Yeah.
But I eventually got uncomfortable with myself.
Oh.
I was trying, this is when Donnie and I were trying to reach people at NSU. And we were trying, you know, it was college kids. So that was part of my reasoning. And eventually I cut it. And I just, you know, to be with the New Testament Baptist Church up there in Natchitoches. Then when I came down to LSU, well, I was amongst college again at LSU,
right.
And our church was very young at the time. Boom, I let it go again. You know, for the same reasons, thinking that, well, you know, trying to, you know, deal with college people and this sort of thing. It was kind of a, I guess, trying to be one of them. And I think there's a sense where you can go a little too far with that. I think, you know, one of the things I was asked yesterday at the Capitol, this is regarding the LGBT types and Q, whatever they are. They said, they often say, this was a question put at me, and he was asking it, and he said, their side often says that, well, Jesus, you know, ate with the sinners, he was friends with the tax collectors and the publicans and so on. He said, what would you say to that? And it was, for me at that point, it was pretty easy. And I was just said that I hear that twisted a lot. And I said, Jesus did those things, and notice he did not sin with those people. He did not sin with the whores and the whoremongers. He did not sin with the tax collectors. He did not sin with the drunkards. You know, and so, you know, that's the thing. You know, you have to be careful, because even like something with long hair, eventually, you know, one of the things that I know, you look back over it in the 60s and so on, that long hair became a rebellion. Long hair in the men, it became a rebellion. I remember reading Abby Hoffman, a good old comic, you know, from the 60s, and Abby Hoffman talking about what's the first thing they do when they get in the military, you know, they shave off all your hair, you know, all this good, right? And so it's a rebellion against the system, you know, let your hair grow long and, you know, all this good. You know, just things like that. That was the spirit of the age, and you can see it. The men let their hair grow long, the women chop their hair off, you know, and so you gotta, I don't know, you have to really be careful, and like you said, you know, your attitude, your heart, you got to get before the Lord with these things. You know, right now where I'm at, the long hair is not a necessity. You know, I can't really justify it.
Especially since we lose a lot of it. So.
Yeah, well, right now, praise God, I'm thankful I still have, you know, but just the point that, you know, you can look at it, there is a sense that in the culture, when it started coming out, it was rebellion. It was a rebellion against the system. It was against the status quo, against the norm, and you could see it. And it was among the youth.
Yeah.
And so,
yeah.
Last little question here. Maybe I'll be on. I haven't really noticed this, but in verse 14, when he talks about a man having long hair, it's assumed it's long hair on his head. Mark Argo had a long beard. Is that long hair? Down to here?
I think that would be, in the other the scriptures where you go back to the Old Testament where it talks about not shaving the corners of your beard. You know, that kind of thing.
There's long hair.
I mean, in other words, In other words, if you wanted to get into that kind of an argument, I think it's a different argument. Yeah.
You got to have long hair for the oil to go down Aaron's beard.
Yeah.
I have a question, though, Mark.
He's specifically making it a head covering here.
He's not talking about a beard. Hold on here real quick.
Lemon thing here. All right. He really changes. And I just was curious because I've always had a long time of reading the Bible, how chapter 11 goes from that to the Lord's
Supper.
In the same chapter, in one verse transition. So was this kind of like just a little time out that he dressed the hair thing, the covering thing, and kind of the church behavior? Or is there a connection to the...
Well, what's the connection between the two sections? The public, they're publicly gathered.
Right, that's why I was wondering if this is more like not a sideshow, but just kind of addressing, not a rabbit, but an issue within a bigger context.
Probably. I mean, you had people dying in the second section because they weren't waiting long enough.
Yeah.
You think about that. Right. I mean, could people be dying in the first section because you just don't get in here and be contentious? I mean, that's dangerous territory to be. I mean, so this whole chapter is dealing with when they gather together. You know, obviously they're praying and prophesying in this first section, but they're eating of the Lord's Supper in the second. And I mean, whether it's, you know, you want to have a symbol of authority on your head because of the angels, and you don't want to be contentious, you had people dying because they wouldn't wait on one another in the second hand. I mean, God takes serious when we gather together. We do things in a submissive and a servant kind of way toward one another. So that would be the connecting common denominator to me between the two sections. Gary, you going to have a point?
Yeah, I like what Tom was sharing, you know, his point of view on that. I agree a lot with them. I think one of the big things behind this, though, if you look at Deuteronomy 22:5, he says, "The woman shall not wear that which pertaineth to a man, neither shall a man put on a woman's garment, for all that do so are abomination unto the Lord thy God." Yeah. I think, you know, the hair thing, a man ought to look like a man, a woman ought to look like a woman, and when folks look at them, they ought to be able to tell the difference. I think a man can, you know, have a little bit longer hair, yet still everybody knows that's a man. You know, he's not trying to look like a woman. Nobody's really confused by it.
Right. So if that quote-unquote woman, Rachel Levine, ever got converted, she, quote-unquote, would have to go back and embrace his masculinity. By necessity, repentance would demand that on his part, because that's how he was created. That's why Caitlyn Jenner, I would make the statement, Caitlyn Jenner's name's not in the Lamb's Book of Life. Maybe Bruce, but he'd have to go back to Bruce if that's the case. He cannot stay in that condition. That's not how he was created. And God's not going to save a man, put him in a dishonorable position, and leave him in a dishonorable position. It just wouldn't make any sense. They fight against everything that repentance talks about and demands. So. And in our culture, we have to say that. We have to actually say that and make that kind of requirement for a person to become a Christian. And you want to become a Christian? Great, you'll need to repent. Okay, yeah, I'm good. Can I keep my dresses? No, you can't. And you're going to have to give them back, burn them, whatever. And you can't pretend to be a woman. You're going to have to be a woman.
So does that say, I mean, they had these issues back then. They had homosexuality. But apparently, I mean, where you have to say for a man to be dressed as a woman or for a woman to look like a man, apparently it was going on in the backdrop, you know. So it's nothing new under the sun. Just seems like it's just blatant and
it's mainstream.
Not
now.
Even
That's what's
slow
different.
Boil anymore. It's just, but it's always been there. From what I mean, it's indicated that it's there. I mean, I'm not justifying. I'm just going, oh, it's always been there. It's just up front.
It's been in the closet, as we said. It's been in the closet.
Right.
What was it, J. Edgar Hoover used to wear a woman's clothing, you know, whatever I used to hear, or something like that. So you don't hear about that when he was alive. You hear about that. But that's like mainstream. That's what pride's all about. See, he's coming out of the closet and putting in everybody's face. And basically, the face they put in front of is God's. And it's just, I mean, so. Why would somebody do that?
Like somebody was saying, it's the position of the heart. One time I was in a restaurant, and I could see the back of the guy's head and kind of his face, too. And his hair was long and gray, kind of, and it was like long as mine, and it was like out to there. And so two times, maybe one time was the hostess, and the next one was the waitress. They'd come up from behind him and didn't see his face, and they addressed him, and, "Ma'am, what would you like to have to drink?" And he would turn his face, and they're like, "Oh, I'm sorry, sir." I mean, he was not trying to look like a woman, but his long hair from the back, he got what he asked for. Sure. You know? And he was embarrassed because it happened twice in a row, you know, same table, same meal, same restaurant. So, it's like you get what you ask for sometimes.
Well, I had a friend, he got asked to dance, and I saw the next day his hair was short.
He got asked to dance.
What's those lyrics of Bob Seger on Turn the Page? Come in from the cold, shake it off, and they don't know whether you're a man or a woman. He gets immense, like, "Well, bro, you did it to yourself." That's why. So, right. Like, well, you know, tough. You're mad about it. You conform to the categories. But you know. Go ahead, Fred.
Back in the Lord's time, back then, didn't they all wear dresses?
Not dresses. They had these tunics. And you can tie them up, and you can definitely make them so it's masculine. And then you had some that were not, that were made for feminine. Now, you could feminize it. Hmm. It wasn't just one big garment that, you know. Hmm. Now, maybe the undergarment was kind of like that, you know, kind of thing. But yeah, look on Google for that, Fred. Check it out.
Okay.
Maybe one last one, which is always a conundrum for me. I mean, guys kind of become girls and all that. I mean, but when girls try to become guys, and you've seen it more and more. I think of this woman that transitioned over into a man. She was an actress.
Oh,
Paige or whatever.
Yeah, Paige. Elliot. She was Ellen Page.
Well, she had a mastectomy. And so now she goes shirtless. Now, because she's a guy. But to me, it's like, that's obscenity there. Because here's a woman, you know, going topless. It's a woman, see, and she's topless, but she's identified as this. You're going to find more of that, more and more. And to me, it's like, you know, if you're a cop, what do? You arrest that woman doing that? Because that's a woman doing that. But identify as this, it's like, well, then they get free reign, free pass. And so I'm just saying, we're going to see more and more of that type of, you know, if I identify as whatever, you got to respect it. And I can get out here and, you know, like you're dealing with that at the prison, you know. Well, if you still got the body parts, I'm still going to treat you as this, that, or whatever. But it's like, what happens when they start messing with the body parts? It's,
well, for whatever reason, body modification is big with criminals.
There you go. So. Guys, we appreciate it. Let's go ahead. Anybody else before we close? This is a lot to think about. So.
Thank
you. Ask Brother Tom to close us in prayer, if you don't mind, Brother.
Well, Father in heaven, we do thank you this evening that we can come together, Lord. We thank you for your word. Lord, we do know that our brothers told us many times, Father, there are things that are easy to understand and just hard to accept. And there's some of those times where the things are hard to understand. And we seek to be able to understand that we might accept and we might apply. And thank you for this evening, Lord, as we're able to spend time in your word and look at these things together. Thank you, Father, for the divine order that you've set up, your kingdom. Father, the things that you have, in your wisdom, that you have set up, Father, for men and for women. We ask, Lord, that you would give us a greater understanding, a greater wisdom of these things that oftentimes should be very simple and easy to understand. And yet, Lord, we know our world situation wants to confuse it. We see the attack on the order. We see the attack on the order, Father, almost daily. I pray you cause us, Lord, to be faithful, not to be different for difference's sake, but that, Father, if we're different, it's for your sake, that it's to glorify you, that we would be faithful to your divine order, to your law, to your word, and that, Father, this is what people would see, and they would glorify you in heaven. Thank you again, Father, for this time. I pray, Lord, that you would see us all safely home tonight. Thank you in Jesus' name.